Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing alternative points of view into challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. I'm back in Columbus now, but barely unpacked, just beginning to settle in and clean up the garden a bit and get my candle-making and pottery gear primed up for the season, etc. But I did manage to get an interview before I left Arizona with someone from the Center for Biological Diversity about the impacts of the border wall and the impacts that it has had thus far. You may recall that a couple of years ago, I spoke with the Center for Biological Diversity's Lakin Jordahl about the potential impacts of Trump's border wall on the environment and various species of plants and animals in the Southwest. We got a little philosophical, too, when we discussed larger issues of immigration and its causes and benefits. As it turns out, many of Jordahl's predictions were right, and the level of harm done both in the construction of the wall and by its continuing presence is now becoming apparent and quantifiable. The politics surrounding the wall also have legal ramifications that are destructive to democracy, accountability, and the rule of law. I met with Miles Traffigan, Borderlands Program Director for the Center of Biological Diversity, to get an update. We also have a clip from a podcast called Rising with Kim Iverson discussing some of the more underreported perspectives on the Ukraine conflict. And the verdict came in the federal case against two Columbus police officers and the killing of Columbus resident Henry Green some 6 years ago. A federal jury found the officers not guilty of violating Henry Green's civil rights. First to the situation on the border, the U.S. border with Mexico stretches for just about 2,000 miles, bisecting habitats and traversing terrains and dividing both people and nations. But for wildlife, the wall before Trump didn't pose too great of an obstacle. The newly enhanced wall is less permeable, preventing the natural migrations of many species, effectively dividing populations and thus reducing genetic diversity on both sides. Humans are adversely affected too, of course, as the wall indeed the border itself, as drawn, divides nations like the Yaqui and the Tohono O'odham people. It degrades parklands where it requires access roads and lights in the fragile desert landscape as well. Furthermore, it does not do what its designers intended, which is to reduce the number of immigrants seeking access to the U.S., whose numbers have increased recently due to escalating violence in the U.S. client states in Central America, several of which are in a state of political crisis brought about in large part by U.S. trade policies and aid to corrupt regimes. But the wall couldn't have been built without suspending dozens of state and local laws, mostly aimed at protecting the environment. A clause in the so-called Real ID Act, an anti-immigrant measure adopted in 2005, allows the Department of Homeland Security to unilaterally waive those laws, something that most of you, I'm guessing, weren't aware of and some lawmakers apparently overlooked. Indeed, Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema initially opposed the Real ID Act, claiming that it violated citizens' right to privacy, but she now serves on the Senate committee that proposed revisions to the law in 2020, and which left the clause regarding suspension of environmental protections intact and unchanged. In fact, it wasn't even mentioned in the committee's report. Miles Traffigan of the Center for Biological Diversity met with me on a windy day in Tucson. My apologies for the audio artifacts caused by wind gusts in the following recording. I think we'll be all right. Okay, so just go ahead and introduce yourself really quickly, and we'll start right in asking about the border wall, if that's all right.
Okay. My name is Miles Traffigan. I'm in Tucson, Arizona. I'm the Borderlands Program Coordinator for Wildlands Network, and I've been working on border wall issues for the last 5 years.
So several years ago that I spoke with one of your colleagues about the potential impact of the border wall, at that time not much of the construction had happened. Some construction did take place and was halted, and I know that it might be difficult to review exactly what those impacts have been. What do you know about, how the border wall, such as it is, in its unfinished state, has impacted things like migration, water, other environmental issues?
Well, probably when you spoke to Lake and Jordahl back in, I'm probably guessing 2018, because at that point they had announced the first round of border wall projects. There were 11 of those that they used a set of funding from the Department of Defense known as Section 284. It's a drug interdiction fund. And there was an injunction placed on the initial round of border wall construction because it was being challenged in court. That only lasted about a month before they resumed construction. And it was a really unfortunate incident because the U.S. District Court, Ninth Circuit in California, had ruled that it was unconstitutional because the Trump administration had asked for funds for building border wall, and the Congress gave them $1.87 billion, but they wanted $5 billion. So the Ninth Circuit Court also upheld the same ruling and the injunction. And in a very rare circumstance, the Supreme Court, who was on recess at that point, reconvened and put a stay on that injunction. So basically that means that they said, we'll let it go forth and we'll review the case next year. The logic of that to anybody who has any critical thinking skills is utterly absurd, to allow a project that would have irreversible impacts upon the land to take place.
So at the time, we felt that the border wall would affect animal migrations as well as human migrations. Has there been any measurable impact on species?
Yeah, there definitely has been. So what happened was, during the Trump administration, 455 miles of border wall were built from Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, and California. The majority of that occurring in Arizona, as a percentage-wise. We've seen notable impacts, specifically at the San Bernardino National Wildlife Refuge, which is located in southeastern Arizona, east of Douglas. We started monitoring wildlife movements with trail cameras beginning in 2019. And what we saw was that after the wall was completed, most large animal movement ceased. By large animals, I mean mule deer, white-tailed deer, javelina, bobcats, and mountain lions. What's really notable about this is that the direction of mountain lion movements changed dramatically. Prior to the wall construction, the movements along these streams and drainages where they primarily migrate were about a 50-50 distribution, meaning 50% of the detections were mountain lions moving north, 50% of the other detections were mountain lions moving south. After the wall was completed, 100% of the detections were from north to south. So envision this. A mountain lion is traveling from the U.S., heading towards Mexico. It's going down a stream. All of a sudden, it encounters this border wall that's impermeable because there's only 4-inch gaps between the steel slats. Well, it either has to go left or right, east or west, and then probably goes along the wall for a certain distance and then turns around and repeats the same cycle over and over again. So this is really an unfortunate thing that's happened, and it's basically what we've predicted would be the case. And there's a few other notable data points and incidents as well that I can elaborate more on.
In California, in Los Angeles, at Agoura Hills, a suburb of Los Angeles, they are just now beginning construction on a land bridge over the very busy 101 freeway, which sees something like 300,000 vehicles a day, to allow migrations between the Santa Monica National Park and the inland protected wild areas. And studies there had shown that the resident populations of animals on both sides of the highway had developed such a lack of genetic diversity that the species was vulnerable to diseases and other stress factors that could cause its significant diminishment. So what impact does that have on the species here if some mountain lions can't get from north to south or vice versa? Are the populations on either side large enough to withstand that kind of denial of genetic diversity?
Well, you know, that's a good point, and that's something that we're all very interested in knowing the answer to. The border wall is basically an uncontrolled ecological experiment, especially because it was built before we were able to collect any baseline data. Now, in any other federal project of this magnitude, studies would have had to have been performed, such as environmental impact statements, following the NEPA process, National Environmental Policy Act, and numerous other processes. They would come up with alternatives. Alternative A is do nothing. Alternative B creates some sort of other barrier. C, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We simply don't know what's going to be the long-term outcome of an impermeable border barrier on the wildlife of the region. Certainly, populations of mountain lions, deer, common species are, you know, sufficient on both sides of the border so that, you know, we're not going to see extinction events. You know, extinction is a big word, and you have to really be judicious when you're using those sort of terms. However, I expect that there will be regional die-offs of a lot of common species, such as deer, javelina, which is the wild pig that's native to this area. And we simply don't know what's going to happen. You know, this could cascade through the food chain, because when prey species are depleted, then the predators will suffer. And in a place like the arid borderlands of southeastern Arizona and southwestern Arizona, New Mexico, big parts of California as well, there's not a lot of surface water, and it's very ephemeral. So this surface water comes in events. We have a summer monsoon season here, so we get, you know, big downpours of desert rain, a lot of lightning. You know, everybody's probably seen pictures of these desert storms that occur here. They're quite majestic. But those are quite erratic. They're not like a frontal system that comes and delivers water across a region fairly evenly. It could rain in one area and not rain in another spot for a year or more. So these water sources and food sources that the native wildlife have grown accustomed to utilizing throughout changing seasons, changing conditions from year to year and season to season, those may not be available to them. And that's the real fear, is that we could have populations of animals, families of javelina, families of deer, who could starve to death, who could die due to lack of water. And we may not even know about it, because this is all occurring in wild areas that, you know, we weren't able to monitor and know where these animals lived and what their populations were prior to the border wall.
You mentioned water. I understand that even during the construction of the wall, depletion of water due to pumping water out of aquifers and even surface water to mix with cement or run the equipment, etc., was a serious issue. Including one particular aquifer in under the Organ Pipe National Monument, which may not be able to be replenished because rainfall is so greatly reduced now that not enough water trickles down into the aquifer anymore to replenish what was extracted at the rate that it was extracted. Have you seen those signs? Are those apparent now?
That's a really difficult thing to monitor. And in the case of a place like Quito-Baquito Springs at Organ Pipe, which is the place of interest where there's the Quito-Baquito Springs pupfish as well as a mud turtle, and also being the only large natural source of water in the area for tens of miles. That water aquifer is not well understood. It's been researched for a long time. It's a very complex system because there's a lot of underground faulting, and it's not entirely replenished by surface water replenishment, meaning, you know, rainfall doesn't refill the aquifer. A lot of this is very ancient aquifer. A place that we know a little bit more about this is the San Bernardino National Wildlife Refuge, where the refuge was established for the protection of native fishes. And this is the upper end of the Rio Yaqui drainage, which flows into the Sea of Cortez in Mexico, ultimately. And there's four species of endangered fish that live on the refuge. The Yaqui catfish, the beautiful shiner, the Yaki top minnow, and the Yaki chub. And the Yaki catfish being the only catfish native to the western slope of North America. This water that feeds the ponds is fossil groundwater. They are artesian wells, meaning that they come out under their own natural pressure. They're slightly warm, about 80 degrees, considered thermal by USGS standards. This water is thousands of years old, most likely dating back to the Pleistocene. So we're looking at Ice Age water that flows out into the ponds and the refuge. So it doesn't matter if we had 100 inches of rain next year, that's not going to affect this fossil groundwater. Once you pump that out of the ground, you lose it. It's gone. Much like the Oglala Aquifer that lies beneath the Great Plains. It's a finite resource. So, here we are using billions of gallons of water to mix concrete. So we're taking water from the Ice Age to build a Stone Age structure.
And you spent a lot of time in your career studying the San Bernardino. What are some of the visual changes that listeners can relate to? What can you actually see now that's different?
Oh, it's a horrible scene. I had a meeting with the Bureau of Land Management a few months ago with the U.S. Senator on site in New Mexico. And they talked about VRM. And, there's a lot of anachronisms in government. So I finally had to say, excuse me, what is VRM? They said, oh, that's Visual Resource Management. I thought that was interesting. And so federal government agencies, such as the Bureau of Land Management, National Park Service, they have guidelines to say that you can't build structures if it's going to affect the visual resource. And the visual resource destruction is just off the chart down here. You see this giant 30-foot steel hulking structure that puts a straight line across a landscape that has been wide open and free for millions of years. This is just simply unacceptable for a country who has pioneered land protection, species protection, cultural resources, and archaeological protection going back, over 100 years. For us to essentially, throw away the baby with the bathwater and destroy the lands that we're trying to protect is really a sad statement of where we have arrived at a country and in dealing with a problem that is largely a matter of socioeconomics, and that we have had a major role in creating the conditions that have caused migration.
That's a good segue into a discussion about Oak Flat. But before we get there, I want to ask, I understand that one of the mechanisms that the Trump administration used to circumvent environmental regulations with regard to the wall construction was a clause in the Real ID Act, which had to do with alleged voting issues that allows the federal government to simply bypass or waive environmental protections if they are seen to be impeding anything related to so-called national security.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the national security card is played routinely now in American politics. So Section 102 of the Real ID Act of 2005 allows the Secretary of Homeland Security to waive virtually all laws for the construction of border barriers in the name of national security. There have been about 70 laws that have been waived. This includes the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Antiquities Act, and the list goes on to laws dating back to 1890, which is the Rivers and Harbors Protection Act. This is a slippery slope to fascism, because how can one person who is a politically appointed official, not even elected, and in the case of the Trump administration, the last four were not even confirmed by the Senate. How do they have the authority to waive laws that were enacted by both houses of Congress, and signed into law by the sitting president, and then surviving a century or more of judicial review. We really need to look hard at this because we're ceding our democracy to the boogeyman of national security. And there's a lot of other issues that that arise out of that, but I think that it was probably the lowest moment in the wisdom of Congress in my lifetime to allow such a law to happen.
I know that Congressman Grijalva from Arizona here had pledged to initiate an effort to repeal that act. Has that happened, or has that gained any traction?
No, bills are introduced every session of Congress, and they are the number of bills that are out there to repeal this. However, there is always a competing force, and even more so, there's efforts on the right to codify this even further and to extend the boundaries of Homeland Security's authority even further. The latest is 100 miles from the border. That would reach, 2/3 of the American population would be stripped of due process and basically, have no Fourth Amendment protections, but also our lands would have no protection from land use and abuse like we've seen at the border. One thing that's important to note is that when the border wall construction began in 2018, immigration rates were lower than they've been in 40 years, and the Border Patrol had no plans and no ambition of building a border wall. They even said that they didn't need one. Now we've constructed 455 miles of border wall, and immigration rates are at their highest in the last several decades. So that shows you the effectiveness of the border wall, is that it's simply an ineffective structure that costs $15 to $18 billion to solve a problem that is really of 21st century making, and it's time that we start actually managing our natural resources and managing our efforts as a nation to solve problems using data, using the numbers, and to have sane and sensible solutions to these problems. Actually sit down and talk about what the problems are and how best to go about solving those issues versus putting up some structure that is basically the most expensive re-election campaign prop in human history.
Well, that's a third possible segue into a discussion about Oak Flat. So you talked about cultural preservation. That's one of the issues. Of course, listeners to this show are familiar with the Oak Flat issue, and I'll recap it in the narration, but I understand that the Biden administration last year had upheld or moved to urged to uphold a lower court's injunction against the lawsuit that had been brought, claiming that if the mine at Oak Flats were to be permitted, that cultural heritage sites that are still very relevant to the Apache people in San Carlos in an ongoing way would be completely obliterated. And then there was a meeting more recently, just a month or so ago. Do you know anything about that meeting and how that went? I mean, what is the status of Oak Flats now?
Oak Flat is, that's currently being litigated there. And one of the more recent bills introduced to extend the Department of Homeland Security authority, this would apply to all federal properties, meaning national forests, national grasslands, national wildlife refuge, that the Department of Homeland Security would have authority over these sites and allow the waiver of laws. I've always had a sneaking suspicion that the Real ID Act of 2005 is the wish list for the Chamber of Commerce, for the American Legislative Exchange Council, and for big business to just cut through all the so-called red tape, which I call safety tape, and eliminate, all regulation and oversight for industrial and business activities. I think that that's really the backdoor Trojan horses that we're looking at here. And especially because copper could be extended as a national security resource. I could see that easily happening. You know, the political winds change rapidly now, and the border wall is a political football, and things like, you know, Oak Flats are as well. And but the real flaw in this, the really Achilles heel in the thinking along the, you know, what I would call the right wing, and I don't use that term loosely, but the agenda for a certain side of America, that they that the Achilles heel is that the 1872 mining law allows you to use federal lands and pay very little royalties. We're talking pennies. And the majority of these mining companies are international firms. They are Australian, such as Rio Tinto with Oak Flat. Hud Bay at the Rosemont Mine is a Canadian-owned company, and there's numerous Saudi Arabian-owned companies. So how can any red-blooded, corn-fed, you know, hamburger-eaten, apple-pie American really support the offshore extraction of our natural resources and the destruction of our land and our waters and our forests and our wildlife in order to give it all away to foreign entities who basically have to pay nothing for it?
So is Oak Flat still in the kind of limbo? Is it still in imminent danger? Are the appeals running out, so to speak? In your prediction, is it likely that the mine will proceed at this point unless there's some kind of radical intervention that's unforeseen?
Well, currently it's in a better position than it's been. And there's been several injunctions on, you know, both the Oak Flat mine and as well as the Rosemont mine. In fact, just 2 days ago, the Pascua Yaqui and the Tohono O'odham filed lawsuits seeking an injunction against the activities at the mine closer here to Tucson. That's the Rosemont mine. The shifting political winds are always the driving factor for a lot of these projects, and even more so today with our politically polarized environment. There's a case close to Tucson here where there was a large housing development near the San Pedro River called, I believe it's called Vignetto. And there was a U.S. Fish and Wildlife official that was pressured by Trump administration lawyers to basically write the decision the way they wanted to see that written. I predict that that is going to be the driving force for most of these projects, such as Oak Flat, the Rosemont Mine, going forth, because so much hinges upon federal judges, and the decks have been stacked for, you know, decades to come through Mitch McConnell and the efforts of the Trump administration to put their people in there to promote these projects. It's really a hypocrisy to try to allow projects that are owned by foreign companies when, you know, all you ever hear is, you know, China this and China that, and, you know, or, you know, we've got this resurgence of nationalism here. And the 1872 mining law was written in 1872 when the expansion of business across the continent, the extraction of resources to build, you know, the current infrastructure of America, you know, that was happening then. But that era has passed, yet that law has stayed on the books. And it's time for the 1872 mining law to be repealed.
So I understand that there are economic pressures as well with regard to development. I mean, you mentioned housing projects. There's a very large housing project slated to go in on the east side of Highway 60, east of Apache Junction, which would kind of put it in line with the Queen Creek watershed, and just below the potential mine at Oak Flat. And although the immediate communities there, Miami and Superior, and of course the Boyce Thompson Arboretum, would be the most adversely affected in the short term, I understand that the water use there for the construction and operation of the mine, which is slated to last some 40 years, may also lower or even drain the aquifer that this new development that's proposed on the east side of the 60 there, I guess it's the east side of the 60. It's east of Apache Junction on at least one side of the 60. Some 800 housing units are being planned to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. And if that water becomes unavailable, then that pits one economic pressure against the other. On the one hand, you have the revenue and the jobs, most of which would go to people from out of state anyway, but then you also have the housing. How do you see that playing out? Is that going to... is that housing development going to count in favor for the people opposed to the Oak Flat mine? And if the Oak Flat mine doesn't go in, does that mean that the housing development is more likely?
I believe that the housing development may be on Arizona State Trust lands. And so the state of Arizona would serve to make a lot of money off that land. And, you know, why are people moving to there? Why would you want to live in a development there? It's because of places like the National Forest, like Oak Flat, like the area surrounding there. If people really wanted to find, you know, housing developments at a good low cost, they'd go further up the road to Globe. You go to Globe, you know, that's already been, you know, turned into basically a mining city. I don't see people buying homes right next to a big giant copper mine, living next to tailings, living next to water that could potentially have, you know, toxic waste in there. The water that soaks into the aquifer at Oak Flat feeds Devil's Canyon and Mineral Creek. Both are extremely important perennial water sources, hidden to most people because they're fairly deep canyons, inaccessible. You have to kind of know where to go. So I think that the local residents in places like Superior, Apache Junction, need to look past the American mantra of jobs, 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 and look towards life, 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 because the mining industry is prone to boom and bust. It's not a sustainable industry. It's finite. And once they extract the material they need and the water that they need, they're going to leave. And then we're essentially left with nothing. We're left with a big waste pile that we can see all around the planet, regardless of any of the rules that say, oh, you need to restore this and, you know, leave it the way it was. That's simply impossible when you have an operation like the Oak Flat Mine where they're going to do this block mining where they basically, they're going to carve into the side, tunnels into the side of the mountains and pull out the copper, and then the overburden of several thousand feet of material is going to collapse onto the next one, and then they'll keep on mining that out. So it's going to be this, basically the creation of a giant sinkhole is what's going to occur. You know, Arizona prides itself on its natural resources, the Grand Canyon State. You look at the license plates here and everything, but the politicians in Arizona and the authorities in charge, when it comes down to it, they don't seem to really cherish their natural resources and manage by the numbers. If you look at the amount of dollars that tourism brings into Arizona, whether it's, you know, the Grand Canyon, Oregon Pipe, spring training in Phoenix for baseball, and all of those people are going to recreate on the weekends in Sedona. They're going to go up to places like Oak Flat. They're simply ignoring the actual numbers in the name of tribal politics, which so happen to have things like mining and industry as part of them, because that's part of that red-blooded American, you know, thing.
And lastly, what are some of the avenues for optimism here? Are there any bright lights on the horizon? Do you see movements developing? Do you see politics shifting in any way that might mitigate some of these disasters before they're allowed to fully unfold?
I wish I could, be more optimistic. I wish, it could be more like, you're watching the Discovery Channel and all these species are doomed, but at the end they say, oh, there's a ray of hope. I don't see a lot of hope on the horizon. When these things are used as political tools, and as Lao Tzu said, every tool is a weapon and every weapon is a tool, but in this case it's used as a weapon, it puts, I guess, people who are thinkers and people who are problem solvers in a bad position, because the tribal drumbeat comes easy in the form of three-word chants, such as build the wall, lock her up, and finish the wall. All you got to do is watch the evening news in Arizona, and every person running for Senate or the governor's race in Arizona, the right-wing candidates, are more extreme. It's just all build the wall, and the next one was all build it even higher. The next one says all build a moat, so we'll put piranhas there. And it's just, how far are we going to go? Are we going to have, electric fence and guard posts and turn this into East Berlin? I mean, it's just, I find it insane that the party of Reagan, the party of Lincoln, who, are always touting, the great Ronald Reagan, would want to turn our country into the wall that he helped take down in East Berlin. We've really lost our way as a country, and I think we need a new calibration on the compass here if we're going to make any headway towards some sane and just solutions for our land and for all the people who live in our hemisphere, in our country.
And so where would you suggest listeners focus their efforts to make a difference in any of these fronts?
They really need to just look at the facts and understand the causes of migration. And I like to use the term migration because migration is a natural phenomenon that has occurred for all species on the planet since the Big Bang, at least since the formation of life on Earth. Species migrate to find better resources because something may be depleted in your area. It may change in space or time, and you need to move to find that. We have a long history of that in this country. The Dust Bowl being the most recent example of mass migrations of people who were leaving one area because of drought conditions, because of misuse of natural resources, to find something better somewhere else that they can create. And migration is going to become a central issue of the coming decades. Right now they're building a border wall between Poland and Belarus in response, a knee-jerk response to just a few thousand Muslims that came across the border. You can't overlook the racist aspect of this, too. There's a lot of racial politics that go on with border barriers. The root causes of this migration, I'll use the border wall here as an example. During the Trump campaigns, they talked about MS-13, this gang that's coming across the border. Well, MS-13 was created in the penal systems of California and Arizona. These were prison gangs that formed. As soon as those people are released from prison, they deport them. So here you had all these hardened, trained, well-organized criminals on the inside and the out being deported to El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, Mexico. And then they come back, or the people are fleeing their villages and homelands because they're being terrorized at criminals that we created in our penal system here. In addition, there's been a long-term drought in the Central American Dry Corridor because the Central American forest, rainforest, is not as wet as a lot of other places. It's very prone to drought cycles. It's also being prone to hit by hurricanes more and more. So here, people are being affected by conditions that we've created as the industrialized West that have created global warming conditions, created gangs and violence in their homelands. And those people are seeking refuge here. And, you know, what do we do to welcome them? We build a border wall. We enact, you know, Title 42. We do nothing to be the compassionate country and to live up to the, you know, the motto that's inscribed upon the Statue of Liberty.
The Center for Biological Diversity's website is www.biologicaldiversity.org. As the war in the Ukraine now approaches its third month and evidence of the carnage and destruction fills the news broadcast daily, there is still little deviation in news analysis from the standard narrative. Putin and Russia are the aggressor, Ukraine is engaged in legitimate self-defense, and the U.S. and Western allies are only concerned with Ukraine's sovereignty. There is certainly truth to each of those points, but as we've been discussing for the last 6 weeks, that reflects only a narrow and perhaps even misleading portrait of what's going on. And the mainstream media here peppers its reporting with subtle editorialisms and reckless omissions. When, for instance, have you heard any mention of Crimea, where its annexation into Russia is not described as illegal or as having been captured by Russia? When have you heard any discussion about the claims of some top Ukrainian officials about wanting to retake Crimea? We hear about the brutal bombing of in the Donbass region by Russia, and yet, indeed, this is a crime for which no excuse should or can be attempted, but we don't hear about the bombing of Donbass by the Ukrainian military after the U.S.-backed coup in 2014. As I've said every week, one does not have to be reserved in condemning Putin for his egregious crime in invading Ukraine, but it would be irresponsible and not even beneficial to Ukrainians to overlook the malicious role the U.S. policies there have played, both militarily and political and financial. Indeed, there's a large and growing global opposition to that war in Ukraine that seeks to hold both Russia and the U.S. accountable. In this next segment, Kim Iverson of the podcast Rising describes an interesting report from a former NATO official that fills in some of those blanks.
So, Kim, what's on your radar today?
Well, I want to share with you an article I read that paints a very interesting picture of the war in Ukraine. The piece was written by Jacques Beau, a retired colonel in the Swiss intelligence service who spent years as a military analyst for NATO and also worked as head of peacekeeping doctrine for the United Nations. He spent years in Ukraine working to build up the Ukrainian armed forces and analyzing Russia's involvement in the civil conflict in Donbass. Now, the article was originally written in French, but it's been translated by a couple of sources, and it's very long, detailed, and extremely interesting. So I encourage you to read it for yourself. However, I know most people won't, so that's why I want to go over it with you here now. So this piece isn't about what's happening now in the war. Beau says there's actually no real way to know, and anyone who claims they know is lying. He says the Russians actually have extremely good closed communication, despite what the propaganda claims, and it's impossible to really know what they're doing. This piece is a totally different perspective on why the war broke out. Now, many of us have heard about NATO expansion, Nord 2 pipelines, and land grabs, but Beau paints a different picture, and it's quite interesting. So Beau starts off by clarifying that the so-called Russian-backed separatists in the Donbass were not, for the past 8 years, supported in any way by Russia. He said a more accurate description of them would be to call them Russian-speaking autonomous, that they were not seeking to be separate from Ukraine, but instead to be autonomous within the framework of the country. After the overthrow of the elected government in 2014, one of the first things the new government did was remove Russia as one of the official languages, remove Russian as one of the official languages of Ukraine. And this upset the large Russian-speaking population, caused uprisings, as well as emboldened the ultra-nationalists who began attacking and in some cases even massacring the Russian-speaking Ukrainians in various cities like Odessa, Mariupol, Lugansk, and Donetsk. The military started hitting back, trying to tame the unrest, and in the end, Ukraine has been essentially in a civil war since. Now, Beau was in NATO in 2014 working on fighting the proliferation of small arms. His team discovered that none of the weapons being supplied to the rebels were coming from Russia, despite some crude allegations. Instead, the weapons were being supplied by Russian-speaking defectors within the Ukrainian army. In fact, the defections became so numerous that it pushed Ukraine towards the Minsk agreement. both of the agreements, actually. After a couple of years, the Ukrainian military was in dismal condition. The population no longer supported them, and 70 to 90% of the reservists failed to show up for their recalls. Bo was then called up by NATO to help restore the image of the Ukrainian armed forces. Unfortunately, that's a long process, he says, and Ukraine ran out of patience. They then began folding into their ranks the ultra-far-right paramilitary militias we've all heard so much about, the best known being the Azov Battalion. Bo claims that by 2020, those various militias made up 40% of the Ukrainian forces. He describes them as fanatical and brutal individuals who are being armed, financed, and trained by the United States, Great Britain, Canada, and France. In fact, Israel became increasingly upset and alarmed by this. It's well known in Israel that many of these battalions are extremely anti-Semitic. Perhaps this is why Israel has been more reluctant to join in against Russia with the rest of the West and has even tried to broker peace in the conflict. It's doubtful they want to in any way be involved in the arming or training of these individuals. Now, Bo explains that the armed forces are broken into two groups. There's the official Ukrainian military operating the tanks, heavy artillery, and missiles. And then there's the paramilitary groups that are the National Guard. The paramilitary groups are tasked with urban warfare and defending the cities. He explains that it's strategically in the best interest of Russia to clear out the civilians from the city so they can easily target the paramilitary groups. Whereas for the fanatical and brutal militias, it's in their best interest for the civilians to stay and act as shields. Bo explains that the start of the war and perhaps the real reasons for it is not well understood by the mainstream. He says it actually started a year ago when Zelensky issued a decree calling for the recapture of Crimea and began deploying his troops to the southern parts of the country. He said at the same time, several NATO exercises were conducted between the Black Sea and the Baltic Sea, accompanied by a significant increase in reconnaissance flights along the Russian border. Now, fast forward to February of this year, and the Ukraine military began dramatically ramping up shelling against the rebels in Donbas. Bo says in his piece, quote, "On 17th of February, President Joe Biden announced that Russia would attack Ukraine in the next few days. How did he know this? It is a mystery. But since the 16th, the artillery shelling of the population of Donbas increased dramatically. As the daily reports of the OSCE Observer show, naturally, neither the media, nor the European Union, nor NATO, nor any Western government reacts or intervenes. It will be said later that this is Russian disinformation. In fact, it seems that the European Union and some countries have deliberately kept silent about the massacre of the Donbas population, knowing that this would provoke a Russian intervention." Bo claims that prior to the intense increased shelling in Donbas, saboteurs equipped with Western equipment who spoke Polish were caught in the Donbas. They were allegedly seeking to create chemical incidents in Gorlovka, and that was in January when they were caught. Now, Bo says this intense increase in shelling and acts of sabotage were precisely how the Biden administration knew Russia would invade, that essentially the humanitarian situation was becoming so dire against the Russian-speaking population in Donbas that it was either stand by and watch them get massacred or intervene. He said they essentially gambled on Russia intervening. So this begs the question, if Russia was unwilling to get involved for the past 8 years, how bad was the shelling this last time? In conclusion, Bo says there are three reasons for this war: the expansion of NATO, which we're all aware of, the Western refusal to implement the Minsk agreements, which were agreements that gave the Donbas region autonomy while remaining part of Ukraine, and the continuous and repeated attacks on the civilian population of the Donbas over the past 8 years, with a dramatic increase in late February 2022. And he finishes off with some wise words. He says, quote, "We can naturally deplore and condemn the Russian attack, but we, that is, the United States, France, and the European Union in the lead, have created the conditions for a conflict to break out. We show compassion for the Ukrainian people and the 2 million refugees. That is fine. But if we had a modicum of compassion for the same number of refugees from the Ukrainian populations of Donbas massacred by their own government and who sought refuge in Russia for 8 years, none of this would have probably happened." So again, I highly encourage you to read the entire article. It sheds a completely different light on this conflict from someone who is not an American and yet still helped rally Ukrainian troops. He's not pro-Russia by any means. He's dedicated his entire career to NATO, the UN, and Swiss intelligence. I actually found out about it through Oliver Stone, who tweeted it out. Also, Aaron Mate with The Gray Zone has had a chance to interview Bo. And though I haven't seen that interview yet, I do look forward to watching it. So Robbie and Brianna, you know, what's interesting about this piece, I think the most enlightening aspect to it is, you know, Bo points out that a lot of these aggressions were happening coming from the Ukrainian side toward Russia since last year. So they were saying, we're going to take back Crimea. They started amassing troops at the southern border. They then started to say that I actually, prior to the invasion from Russia into Ukraine, I'd been following the leaders, the military leaders, the generals from the Donbas region, the Luhansk and the Donetsk regions. And they had been, actually, you could see their videos. Well, I don't know if you can anymore. I think they've been removed. But they were saying, we are getting intelligence that the Ukrainian military is going to come into Donbas and try to do a hostile takeover of the region again. And so they were sounding the alarm when the U.S. was saying, oh, Russia's going to invade. The Donbas military leaders were saying, we're getting word that the Ukrainians are coming in and they're going to invade us in the civil war conflict. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you could technically call it an invasion if they're invading their own technical territory. But, you know, look, the Western media wouldn't, I think, broadcast the fact that there's intense shelling coming in from the Ukrainian side to Donbas, or that troops are amassing at the borders and threatening to take back Crimea or the Donbas regions. So it's an interesting perspective coming from this NATO official who, again, spent his entire career focusing on Eastern countries and helping build the Ukrainian military. So I found that particularly interesting that we're not getting that side of the perspective. We've been hearing other reasons for the conflict, but this is an interesting one, an interesting new perspective.
Yeah, I think the background really says something. I know a lot of people were first hip to the broader context of what's been going on by a series of writings and panels by John Mearsheimer, who is not exactly like a far right, far left, rather radical leftist or anything like that. And this is all contributed to is an ongoing credibility crisis with the media, that it has taken this long in kind of independent reporting by folks who are often maligned by the mainstream to get a broader perspective on what's going on. Obviously, you know, not everything that's reported from every source is necessarily going to bear out, but it is so much clearer to have these kinds of perspectives and the really flat narrative we were delivered at first, which is simply that Putin's a madman, he's doing a crazy, unprovoked, contextless thing, and we're all just going to have to buckle down and fight this war and fund Raytheon until the last man is standing.
Well, and it points to the difficulty of ever saying, here's when the conflict starts. So you pick some point in time, and then you say, well, here's where it started, so these are the people at fault. And I think you can do that, you know, for the direct causes of what's going on right now. But you can, as you point to, well, what happened before that? What happened before that? We can go back with some of these conflicts. We can go back decades. We can go back a century and find out that a lot of these conflicts have their roots in struggles between people that have been going on since, like, the Middle Ages or before. And it complicates what everyone wants an easy narrative. The media loves an easy narrative. Good guys versus bad guys. Right. It's always more complicated than that in every circumstance, even this one. So I think it's a good point.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and another thing to point out is that this we couldn't even get in Western media. This was written and published, well, at least not here in the United States. This was written in French and published in a French publication. It had to be translated because it was found to be so many people that read it over there. So this is interesting, translated to English for us to read. But otherwise, no one would have picked this up. You know, I mean, so it's, again, that interesting perspective, somebody who's worked on the ground with NATO, again, also shedding a light on those paramilitary groups, saying that, you know, and he even says in the piece, look, we could debate if you want whether or not you want to call them Nazis. Fine. He's like, but they are brutal individuals. And these are people that come in and they are just wanting to kill. That is, you know, it's like you can imagine it. And we're seeing a lot of these foreign fighters coming in. It's that same, like, oh, I just want to get in the fight. And it's like, what kind of mentality does it take, you know, for a person that actively wants to find a paramilitary organization to join? So very interesting piece. Everybody should read it if they have the time. It is very long, but very detailed, very interesting. So I wanted to kind of go over it a bit here today. So thanks for letting me do that.
Well, thank you for that, Kim.
We may have thought, hopefully, that the tide had turned with regard to police accountability in Columbus, and that after all the protests and investigations and indictments and cash settlements and press conferences and federal sanctions and local policy changes, that the likelihood of unjustified police shootings of black and brown folks in Columbus would have subsided. But so much turns on the verdict of high-profile cases. Convict a police officer and it sends a message to the fellow officers that they must be more, must exercise more restraint and be more accountable. Acquit or fail to indict and it may be taken as encouragement to maintain the status quo. It's hard to measure the progress where there might have been any, and harder still to feel secure about any gains that the movement for policing reform might have made. This week, a federal jury acquitted two police officers in the killing of Henry Green 6 years ago. I wasn't back in town yet when that news broke, but in case you missed the news, we have this clip here from our local NBC affiliate.
Well, nearly 6 years after Henry Green was shot and killed in a South Linden neighborhood, the Columbus police officers tied to his death have been cleared in the civil case that they faced. NBC4's Dan Perlman joining us now live with the details on the jury's decision. Dan?
Well, the civil trial, Brad, was held in federal court. As you mentioned, the jury siding with the officers in this case that has gotten a lot of attention over the last several years. June 6th, 2016, Henry Green was shot and killed. Columbus police officers Zachary Rosen and Jason Baer were working a plainclothes detail that day when police say the 23-year-old ignored commands to drop his gun. Green's family and a friend that was with him say the police did not identify themselves when they began yelling at him. Since then, a grand jury declined to indict the officers for their roles in the shooting. The Columbus Division of Police and the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation determined both acted within division policy. The first civil trial ended with a mistrial last year. The jury in this second trial found the officers did not violate Green's constitutional right to be free from excessive force. The jury also found they did not maliciously, in bad faith, wantonly, or recklessly commit assault or battery against him. Columbus City Attorney Zach Klein issued a statement today that reads in part, "The past 5 years have undoubtedly been hard for all of those involved, and we're grateful for the judge and the two juries who devoted the substantial time and attention required to fully understand, deliberate, and ultimately decide this case." Sean Walton, the attorney for Green's mother, said they are disappointed with this verdict, also stating in part, "This civil trial was the first that the city has had to defend for a police shooting in 15 years, and that in itself provides hope and optimism that accountability is on the horizon." And Jeff Simpson with the Fraternal Order of Police, the president, issued a statement as well saying the FOP respects the federal jury's decision. He added the facts and the evidence of this case are crystal clear and beyond reproach. Local for you in Columbus, Dan Perlman, NBC4.
I'll try to follow up on that story in the coming weeks here on Conscious Voices, which airs each week at this time on your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll see you all again next week for another edition. Take care. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM, WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.